All right. I would like for the last session of the conference today. Right? Is that better, Anna Sophia? Yeah. Okay. To say a few words about questions related to some of the issues that Stephen's been talking about and other issues that have to do with the way one might handle from a still dispositionalist approach the questions related to causal powers and causal explanation. Well, as a matter of fact, it's always difficult when dealing with metaphysical issues to be sure one is completely clear about one's ideas and assumptions. And when it comes to such concepts as causation, there are so many traps and pseudo issues that such a piece of advice seems particularly true. Right. Besides, we've all read Russell, and we may have some doubts about the concept of causation itself, and some of us may believe that, well, it just covers anything else, doesn't cover anything else but just plain nonsense. Now, a metaphysician committed to serious work should also take into account some facts. And there are at least two facts, as far as causation is concerned, which seem to be undeniable. First, that apart from philosophers, everybody seems to manage quite well with causation. And to use every causation, every day, I would say, causation talk, right? In the second place, when it comes to professional serious stuff, it's also a fact that in the last decades, there's been a tremendous amount of sophisticated work being done on the concept itself. And so many diverse, precise, carefully articulated, deeply thought theories developed that it would be indeed a cause of despair if one should conclude from the start that all this finally amounted, in fact, to, well, much ado about nothing, right? Indeed, the discussions surrounding causation have been so intense that the first difficulty one encounters, and we have checked it today, is to try and make one's way through all the mazes of the positions. As several of us reminded today, one important view about causation tends to make it a relation between events, which in turn comes in at least two basic and fundamentally different varieties. One of these is dependence, understood in a counterfactual dependence way, between wholly distinct events. And in this sense, event C is a cause of distinct event E, just in case E depends on C. That is, just in case, had C not occurred, E would not have occurred. The second variety tends to view, as Ned Hall said, to view causation more in terms of production, is when we say of an event C that it helps to generate or bring about or produce another event E. So this seems quite commonsensical enough. And usually, this explains why both varieties come together with three main theses, which Ned Hall had presented in that way: transitivity, if event E is a cause of D and D is a cause of E, then if even C is a cause of D and D is a cause of E, then C is a cause of E. Locality, causes are connected to their effects via spatio-temporally continuous sequences of causal intermediates. And intrinsicness, the causal structure of a process is determined by its intrinsic non-causal character, together with the laws. No doubt such distinctions fare quite well with an ontology in which the world is described as a sum of loose and separate existences, as is the case with human types of ontology. However, once you accept such an ontology, you accept the main human premise of there being no necessary connections between distinct existences. And some may think that the notion of causation itself soon becomes very problematic. At least Stephen just gave an illustration a few minutes ago. Does it really exist? Is it just a constant conjunction? Can anything cause anything else? How must events stand to count as causally related? Can we have causal and inductive knowledge? This most common sense and widely accepted group of notions, which is arguably a part of everyone's pre-critical understanding of the world, Stephen notes, is then either rejected outright, or its defenders are forced to fight a rearguard action, presenting ever more elaborate theories to underwrite something as simple and basic, end of quote. So alternative views have been proposed by dispositionalists of all stripes. Most of the time, such views have what we might call a pars destruens and a pars construens. When they don't try to dissolve the concept of causation, namely, it may happen that some of them, and I count myself among them, when they don't dissolve purely the concept, they try to accept the view that there are indeed some strategies relying mostly on a Humean or Lewisian ontology, which might have varying degrees of success in describing what is true when there is causation. But this is, I think, a very good remark that Stephen made in several occasions. The problem is that, from a dispositionalist point of view, that they think they are not, that the people, the dispositionalists, think that precisely they are not about causation itself. So the idea is that people defending the regularity theory, for example, and the counterfactual theory of causation, are simply describing phenomena that follow from real causal connections. So in a way, they are attempts to avoid admitting the reality of causal necessity or causal dispositions of causal powers. So in a way, there is a kind of utifro problem about this. Is there causation because there is constant conjunction, or is there constant conjunction because there is causation? And precisely, the dispositionalists think there will be constant conjunction, counterfactual or even probabilistic potencies and so on, because there are causal connections in nature. So this explains why, after a kind of pars destruens, they of course try to build in the construens pars a new concept of causation and to find the way to offer a reconceptualization, as Stephen said, of causation. But are they right, and are they successful in doing so? Well, precisely, I shall try to see whether they are successful or not. I shall start first with a very quick reminders about the problems, or at least supposed problems, met by Humean accounts of causation. Then I present the merits of the alternatives, namely, basically, of the metaphysics of powers approach. And I shall then present some problems I see with most of the concept used by metaphysicians of powers. And then I'll try to suggest some ways to deal with them through my own approach in terms of kind of a dispositional realism. And time permitting, I offer some general remarks about some basic aspects a genuine approach of causation should focus on in order to improve the methodology of causal explanation. So let me start with the few so-called problems met by Humean approaches to causation. Well, a widely shared view represents the world as a set of atomic entities with a space-time location endowed with irreducible fundamental properties made of solitary mosaics peopled with individuals or substances, characterized by their intrinsic properties, a world of passive entities linked one to the other through merely contingent relations. A prominent contemporary formulation is Lewis's thesis of Humean supervenience. All there is to the world is a vast mosaic of local matters of particular fact, just one little thing and then another. We have geometry, a system of external relations, of spatial-temporal distance between points, maybe points of space-time itself, maybe point-sized bits of matter or ether or fields, maybe both. And at those points, we have local qualities, perfectly natural intrinsic properties, which need nothing bigger than a point at which to be instantiated. For short, we have an arrangement of qualities, and that is all. There is no difference without difference in the arrangement of qualities. All else supervenes on that. Well, thus, there are only local qualities in the sense of intrinsic properties instantiated by space-time points or point-sized particles at space-time points. Okay. So there are no necessary connections between distinct things. The fundamental properties are simple, not complex entities, or, again, structural properties, namely properties composed of other properties, of which it's impossible, more or less, to say much more. Relational properties, in particular, causal powers, melt into or supervene on intrinsic properties, but such a connection is contingent and doesn't provide any knowledge whatsoever of intrinsic properties. This is what leads to the well-known Lewisian humility. If one thing is the basis, another one the causal power, and if the link between the two of them is contingent, then indeed we have no access to the intrinsic properties. We face something we know not what, and we can only identify the properties through the role they occupy, which leads not to Humean, but to Lewisian or Ramseyan utility. So Humean metaphysics presupposes two things as primitive: the network of spatial-temporal relations between points of space-time, and this is what unifies the world. Secondly, the distribution of fundamental physical properties over the whole of space-time. Fundamental physical properties are all and only those physical properties that can occur at a point of space-time: position, velocity, energy, mass, charge, spin, count among the candidates for such properties. So for Lewis, these are natural, intrinsic, categorical properties. You don't have to presuppose anything else as primitive. The description of everything else that there is in the world is to be derived from the description of the distribution of the intrinsic and categorical fundamental physical properties over the whole of space-time. everything else that there is entirely contingent. By way of consequence, the fact that there are regularities in the distribution of the physical properties in space-time, and what these regularities are, has to be accepted also as primitive. Certain of these regularities are laws of nature, which are all and only the theorems of the system that achieves the best balance between simplicity and strength in empirical content, in providing a complete, at least ideally, description of the world. So what the laws of nature are is fixed only at the end of the world. So after humility, a second worry may thus arise. The concern is that the criteria of simplicity and strength are merely subjective, mere epistemic virtues, instead of objective and being anchored in the world. The same goes for causation. According to a Humean regularity view of causation, all there is to causation are certain patterns of spatio-temporarily contiguous coinstantiations of properties over the whole of space-time. Hence, whether or not two given property tokens stand in a relation of cause to effect depends on what else there is in the world, namely on whether or not tokens of the same types are the two given ones, are regularly coinstantiated. So, in a way, causation reduces to the non-causal notions of temporal priority, spatial contiguity, and constant conjunction. Now, as a friend of Powers, John Molnar, commented on such a vision of causation as regularity, I quote Molnar, "The first of a number of theories we've inherited is the one from Hume viewing causation as regularity. Now, there is serious doubt about whether constant conjunction is either necessary or sufficient for causation. Orthodox regularity theories have difficulty in accounting for that paradigm of causality. Causation in a particular instance, singular causation. An even more important objection to a regularity theory, one that is in fact fatal to such theories, is that because there exist both causal irregularities and accidental regularities, the theory is unable to deliver a distinction between post hoc and propter hoc, something that any theory of causation must do. Regularity may be a significant guide in the search for cause, but it's not constitutive of causation. Hume's great idea was born from, in turn reinforced, a tangled mixture of epistemology and metaphysics that we are still trying to unravel today." End of quote. So nothing substantial changes if you switch to a counterfactual account of causation, such as the one proposed by Lewis. Causation then consists in certain counterfactual relations among property tokens. But then we seem to have the same problem with causation in terms of counterfactual dependence. As Molnar writes, "Causes are conditions sine qua non of their effects. It's proved difficult to make this idea immune to counterexamples of the standby causes or of the double preemption kind. The central objection, however, is again one broad principle. We have no satisfactory account of the meaning of strong conditionals except an informal understanding that they express some kind of necessary connection between antecedent and consequent. It has not proved possible to explicate this intuition without implicit circularity. The counterfactuals that state the dependence of some events on others are themselves made true by the existence of some causal nexus between the events in question. David Lewis has made a heroic effort to defend a reductive idea of counterfactual dependence that could be used in a non-circular definition of causation. His analysis of counterfactuals in terms of overall comparative resemblance between possible worlds, succeeds in avoiding the trap of circularity, but only at the expense of making the account of causation irredeemably anthropocentric. Many of us regard this loss of objectivity in the analysis as an indication that Hume's alternative theory of causation also adds to a philosophical dead end. So Humean metaphysics, consequently, faces, of course, the problem of induction, but in a metaphysical form. There's nothing in the past distribution of properties that could make true the prediction that the future distribution of properties will be like the past one. There's nothing in the limited region of space-time considered, or in any region of space-time that is a proper part of the whole of space-time, that can make true the belief that space-time as a whole is like the proper part considered. So, as Michael Esfeld has very rightly pointed out, this is a point about the metaphysical relation of truth-making and not about the epistemological problem of the justification of beliefs acquired by induction. So indeed, we have coherence, simplicity, ideal systematicity of the facts of the world. But is it enough to expect from laws to be regular, but not causal? It seems to me that if we keep to that stance, then first thing, we lose any interesting links between the regularly linked phenomena. We have then, as has been pointed out, a rather thin view of laws. Do regularities suffice to explain laws? How, in particular, can regularities explain their instances? Suppose we say that all diamonds are hard expresses a law expressing a regularity. It will never be enough to say that another diamond will explain that this one is. How, second problem, how will you then distinguish between accidental regularities, mere coincidences, and nomological regularities, which you need to account, for example, for probabilistic laws, or between regularities which apply to very few cases, or even just one? We know the problems faced by the conditional analysis, and also that it's almost impossible to find nomological statements which are true. As Nancy Cartwright often said, we have mere idealizations and abstractions which are not literally true. They are true provided nothing interferes and provided we say that they may encounter exceptions. However, the ceteris paribus clause may be viewed either as incomplete or just merely trivial. Hence, to sum up, on the one hand, Humean metaphysics seem to be parsimonious because it accepts only the distribution of the fundamental physical properties as primitive, and it conceives these properties as being intrinsic and categorical. And on the other hand, there is in Humean metaphysics no answer to the question why the distribution of fundamental physical properties in the universe developed as it did. Causation and law supervene on the distribution, but then they cannot account for it. So if one rejects the idea of there being necessary connections among the property tokens in the world, the consequence is that one has to accept the whole distribution of the fundamental physical properties as primitive. But then, if one doesn't want to stay on that stance, he has, of course, to challenge Humean metaphysics. Now, precisely, people defending various forms of dispositionalism reject the whole apparatus that raises this causation as a problem. They wish to say that, in fact, the connections in which the causal interactions of a thing in virtue of its properties exist can be essential to it. So instead of contingently related cause and effect, they want to say that we have powers. Powers have indeed some connection with their manifestations, but in a way to be elucidated, which remain distinct existences, but with a, I wouldn't say necessary connection, but at least stronger than contingent connection between them. So, at first sight, a metaphysics of powers seems more palatable for those who want to have a clearer approach to causation, or so they say. Causation seems to be now viewed in terms no longer of a mysterious relation, since it is presented as something which is intrinsic to the properties themselves and to the things which have them. Things are viewed as just clusters of capacities, powers, causal processes, dispositions. Then you don't need to find elsewhere in the world the reason for what goes on in the world. The various activities present in the world and the laws that supervene on them are just the expression of the dispositional properties which are all over the place. So the powers ontologist, and of course you know that there are various ways of dealing with this, along the scientific essentialist approach of Brian Ellis or Alexander Bird, various also causal structuralist approaches, accept the view that there might be a form of necessary connection in nature, although they deal with the issue in very different ways. But most of the time, the idea is that at least instead of contingently related cause and effect, we have powers and their manifestations with a certain kind of necessary connection between. And some, whom we might call pan-dispositionalists, go so far as to hold that dispositionality might be, so to speak, a primitive modality, out of which it would be possible to understand what causation is about, and which should be part and parcel of any explanation we might wish to give, not only at the level of the physical properties, but on the level of biological properties, and why not, psychological and social properties. And as Stephen explained a few minutes ago, causation is said to exhibit such a modality which is stronger than mere contingency, but weaker than necessity. The dispositional modality needs not deliver constant conjunctions. Causes tend, and no more than tend, to produce their effects, where the notion of tendency is irreducible. So it's interesting to see that the concept of tendency is very often introduced in the framework. Okay. Now, what are the supposed advantages? A search for something like a unitary and systematic view, of course, in the approach. Also a way of providing a much more optimistic metaphysics than the Humean. And also from the epistemological point of view, it seems also to afford a less skeptical and a less mysterious access to the world, since things now seem to be given access to by the effects they produce on us, and that we seem to have better means also of testing at an empirical level in accord, or very often, with what science tells us. So, what could we hope, right? The important things before being too cheerful about this is to notice that powers are not additional properties. They're just powers which have the power to produce other properties. And as far as the laws of nature are concerned, they simply supervene on the properties. So, for example, if it is a law that all Fs are followed by Gs, this is so because the Fs are the power to produce Gs. As a consequence, instead of the contingent regularity patterns of Humean metaphysics, according to the metaphysics of powers, the laws of nature are metaphysically necessary. If something is a token of the property F, it is the power to produce Gs. Hence, in any world in which there are Fs, the law that Fs produce Gs holds. Well, the same story goes very smoothly again for causation. Causal relations are not a simple pattern of regular contiguous coinstantiations of properties of the same types, but one property token literally produces or brings about another property token, and thus is the ground of the existence of those other property tokens. So indeed, this makes causal difference. Again, no one is forced to view the fundamental physical structures in a causal manner as powers. But as Michael Esfeld, I think, to a certain extent, rightly insisted on, there are mainly three good arguments for doing so. First, applying the causal theory of properties to the fundamental physical structures provides for a clear answer to the question, what distinguishes physical from mathematical structures? Physical structures are causal, whereas mathematical structures are not. Secondly, this conception yields a unified ontology that includes properties such as charge and mass, that is, physical properties for which there is no argument available that is comparable to the arguments from state-dependent properties in entangled states and metrical properties, and that shows that these properties themselves are physical structures. Thirdly, the conception establishes a firm link between the fundamental physical structures, which are theoretical entities, and the observable phenomena, making clear how we can have cognitive access to these structures, thus opening up the way for vindicating a realist attitude towards them. This is in a paper by Esfeld, a 209 paper where he precisely compares the advantages or disadvantages of each metaphysics. There's even another merit, at least at first sight. It's also possible to say, according to such an account, that you can find some this type of causal properties, not only at the level of physics, but of course at the level of such special sciences as biology or psychology. Of course, why? Because in such sciences, functional properties are supposed to be extremely important. And those properties indeed consist in producing certain effects given standard conditions. So if you can give an account in terms of the identity of properties being matchable through a kind of functional analysis, then of course you are in possession of a metaphysics which has an extremely important appeal in terms of the unification of the various sciences. Of course, as is well known, this is not the case with the Humean metaphysics, because it only deals with the distribution of categorical properties. So when you look, for example, as such a position as the one defended by Shoemaker, some people think that it's just tailor-made for functional properties, since then you have a definition of what a property is, which consists in the effects that the property tokens in question produce. So, as a summary, there are two main arguments, apparently, for preferring the metaphysics of Powers style to Humean types of metaphysics. The metaphysics of Powers avoids the commitments to humility and quiddityism. Second, it provides for a complete and coherent ontology that includes the ontological commitments of physics as well as of the special sciences. Well, but also you should always be, of course, extremely skeptical of such wonderful promises, right? So let's see now if it's such a dreamy world. Obviously, the dispositionalist framework faces obvious difficulties. A first big difficulty, of course, is that there is a very big assumption which is made, namely that a good theory of causation may call unproblematically from the theory of powers. But how does it, right? Is it just enough to talk about causal powers, causal relations, in order to give an account of the way that's done? Second, after all, we are told that such entities are primitives, but do we have any good reasons to believe this in the first place? Okay. So, dispositionalists say that the Humean framework leads to skepticism, but can they do better? Well, I think when you look at things, even from a generous perspective, there are a lot of problems that become very apparent soon. Especially if you go completely the other way around and say, not only that there are real dispositional properties, but that all properties are dispositional, or even more strongly, that they are all essentially dispositional, as some say. So if you go all the way down to pan-dispositionalism, then I think you get into a lot of very serious troubles. For the following reasons. First, it just seems quite obvious, at least for anyone who wants to keep some common sense present in philosophy, that there are some properties that seem to be clearly non-dispositional at all. And even some paradigms of categorical properties, structural, typically geometrical properties, even if Hugh Meller, as in a famous paper, tried to say in what way corners could be counted, right? and say that even triangularity might match a dispositional account, right? There are still problems. And even if you don't go along this way, I think it's very difficult to avoid saying that at least there are some laws, some basic laws, laws of symmetry, that you can count as being dispositional. So even if you make a lot of efforts to encompass all properties within the dispositionalist framework, I think it's quite difficult to make sense of this. So that's the first caution. Another challenge is that somehow one is committed to the metaphysical necessity of the laws of nature. And it's true that most of the times our intuitions are rather that laws of nature are contingent. Third challenge, one has to meet the main objection, it seems to me, that has been raised against pan-dispositionalism, namely the objection of idealism. For if one holds, as Hugh Meller does, for example, that all properties are dispositional, that there are dispositional properties all the way round, then you face the risk of a Berkeleyan world with no more distinctions between primary and secondary qualities, a circular world in which, as Russell pointed out, all the things will be merely each other's washing, an incoherent world as shown by the counterfactual analysis in terms of possible worlds, the result of which is the following, as Simon Blackburn has shown. And supposing a world as entirely described by what is true at neighboring worlds, all these truths in turn vanish into truth about yet other neighboring worlds, and the result is that there is no truth anywhere. But in such a world, not only are we obliged to face properties which look as if they had been derealized, or in which the concept of truth seems to be inapplicable, but it's also a world in which, as Armstrong noted, the object always contains in itself, in an essential way, a reference to a manifestation which has not occurred. It points in the direction of something which doesn't exist. For some, incidentally, intentionality, which Brentano took as a distinctive mark of the mental, directed towards non-existent objects or state of affairs, is a mark, not so much of the mental, but, as Hugh Place observed, of the dispositional. Another challenge for dispositionalism is well known. If all the sparse properties are nothing but powers, all serious distinctions between powers and the manifestation of powers get lost. It's hard to model a real happening on such an account. So to put it scholastically, the world never passes from potency to act. Nothing ever happens. For an account of causation, this is bad news. Unreal, incoherent, unbelievable, the world of the dispositionalist doesn't seem to be a very pleasant world to inhabit. Now, how can dispositional realism be a better candidate, though? Well, I'm not going, of course, to go into all the details of precisely the position which I've been developing for quite some time now. Just let me say a few words about what I think are important in my own account. I take most elements of the metaphysics of powers on the board in my own version. What I mean by this is the following. First, I assume a causal theory of properties. However, I insist on three important elements that should be kept in mind by any dispositional realist. First, dispositions are fine, but provided what doesn't forget laws to in the picture. We need dispositions plus laws, otherwise it's just impossible to avoid the mysteries of a purely process world, and to take care of singular causation. So I think it's important in that respect to try and make sense of a conditional dispositionalist account of law, but with some nuances than the ones that have been developed, for example, by Bird or Ellis. Third remark. It seems also to me, so that the second proviso, which is to be very important, that in order to avoid the drawbacks of pan-dispositionalism, events and objects have to be given some reality. So it seems to me that one should stick to a minimal essentialism, a thin essentialism, what I have called a form of aliquiditism, which is somewhat different from quiritism. I don't have the time to go into the details of the position, but it's very important for me to try and make sense of this. What I find very problematic in the accounts that have been offered, for example, by a causal structuralist, although I feel some sympathy with their approaches, is precisely the way that they deal finally with the structures in terms of merely internal relations, taking in the last versions, objects are mere appearances, cannot work. So it seems to me that if you don't give some sense, a minimal sense of what an object is, of what an event is, right, through some lenses, which there's no other way than calling them thinly essentialist, then there's no possibility for you to avoid the various traps I have mentioned. And of course, this might oblige you at some point also to put some emphasis not only on, I agree, to some aspects that have to do with straightforward, efficient, and mechanistic aspects of causation. Namely, it might be the case that in order to make sense of such a world, a dispositional realist world, you might have to make some sense of some kind of teleological explanations within the causal explanation themselves, which I don't find so problematic as some might think in the beginning. I think there have been some attempts being made by John Hawthorne or Nolan lately to try and make sense of precisely some teleological aspects of explanation. So I think these aspects might be brought in a picture which might give sense to a nice account of what a causal explanation might amount to. I don't have time to go in the details, but I would just like to say, in terms of as concluding remarks, if you wish, it seems to me that the problem I see with the type of alternatives, dual alternatives, that a lot of philosophers nowadays say, between either you choose to be along Humean and Lewisian lines, right, or you choose a kind of dispositionalist or metaphysics power approach. I think this is the wrong way of doing things, precisely because I think there are some good things in the metaphysics of powers approach, in terms, for example, of the way they insist on the necessity to look very carefully at the possibility of the heterogeneous characterization of causes, and the necessity also of looking very carefully at the way causes might combine themselves. This is a very interesting aspect, I think, which Manfred, for example, in his last book has paid attention to in the sequel of George Molnar, right? I think this is extremely important in terms of what can count as a good approach from this camp to the causal explanation themselves. However, where I'm much more skeptical is that, and this has to do precisely with the type of very strict dispositional realism you want to have. Of course, if you want to be a realist in terms of disposition, you've got to say that even if dispositions are concepts to a certain extent, right? Because, of course, your realism should at one point become a semantic form of realism. I mean, no metaphysical realism can be adopted seriously, it seems to me, today. So, of course, if you are a dispositional realist, you should accept to say that the real is, to a certain extent, what signifies something real. But then if you are very strict on that, You should also be extremely strict on the necessity of taking logic on board and be very strict on precisely all the necessities of logical analysis, of conceptual analysis, on the counterfactual analysis of conditionals, etc., and never despair of being able to bring something out of just out of the counterfactual analysis. So this is a point. Now, saying that a dispositional realist is someone who accepts the view that real properties should be handled from a conceptual point of view doesn't mean that dispositions are mere concepts, precisely. If he is a realist, he won't buy such a story as the dual aspect theory of disposition, right, or kind of modal or neutral approach to disposition, as also there are some in the market, as we know. If he's a realist, then he really wants to understand the fundamentum, right, of the properties that he is dealing with. And there's no other way in doing this than looking, it seems to me, at matters first from an examination of what is the type of essentialism he has to deal with, on the one hand, and secondly, on a strict observation, examination of the links there are between the causal properties and the laws in nature. It is just provided he follows these two criteria that he will be, it seems to me, able to come to a metaphysics of causal processes and adapt his metaphysics with his epistemology. Thank you.